Any Hour Services free furnace sale is going on right now. The estimate's free, and when you have Any Hour Services install a new air conditioner, we'll give you a new furnace for just the cost to install it. For more information, call Any Hour Services or schedule online at anyhourservices.com. What's up, everybody? I'm Mike Wilson with Any Hour Services, and we're extending our free furnace sale. We still have a few more open spots we're trying to fill on our schedule. Just to recap how the sale works, when you have Any Hour Services install a new air conditioner, we'll give you a new furnace for just the cost to install it. About $400. The furnace is free, you just pay the labor. Call Any Hour Services and schedule your free estimate today. 801-443-7400. You can Google Any Hour Services. You can even schedule online at anyhourservices.com. No one helps more homeowners than Any Hour Services.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
And I'm Sam Abual Samad from Guidehouse Insights. And Rebecca is off babysitting a couple of nephews this evening.
Are they legitimately young nephews? Was that?
Well, I saw one picture that, you know, it was clearly a young kid, so I'm assuming they're young nephews.
Okay.
I know she has an older nephew that was living with her for a while, living in her house, but he's moved out now. So I think she's babysitting for one of her siblings.
So like legitimately babysitting.
Yes, yeah. Legitimately babysitting. All hence, right. She can't be here this evening.
Well, Auntie Rebecca will be back sometime soon. and you know what? It's interesting. The show that you guys did, I was like, when I edited it last week, I was like, oh, God, I wish I was there for that. Because you guys had a question about a sound meter. And
oh, yeah. Well, we can almost come back to that one.
I was like, I have a sound meter. I haven't broken it out in years. But the reason for that is that you can just get a sound meter app for your phone. And
right.
The mic on your phone.
I don't know how accurate those things actually are, though.
It
depends on the mic and things
yeah,
like that.
I mean, there's a little variation. Basically, it'll tell you kind of sort of close enough. But there's a lot that goes into sort of measuring sound, and
yeah.
I don't know how good we'd be at it, you know.
Well, and, you know, there's also, you know, do you measure it in decibels? Do you measure it in sones? Because they're actually measuring two very different things. You know, one is measuring sound pressure,
right?
And sones, you know, decibels is measuring sound pressure, because sound is made by waves, pressure waves in the air, in the atmosphere,
right?
And sones is actually measuring the loudness of the tone and the type of tone it is.
Yeah.
And manufacturers have, you know, over the last, I don't know, it's probably about 20 years. Like, yeah, early 2000s, I think, like when I was still working at TRW as an engineer, you know, and they were doing sound measurements of the ABS systems. They switched from measuring by decibels to measuring by sones because it gave you a better indication of the sound quality.
Right, yeah.
Which is important.
Sones is definitely, I think a lot of industries use sones. But, you know, you can convert sones to dB if you wanted to. Because I think the general public very much understands decibels versus sones, but sones is a much more comprehensive measurement. Like you said, it sort of takes the quality of the noise into account. And even with sound pressure, you know, you got to be careful. Is it A-weighted, which mimics the response of your ear, or is it C-weighted, which is much more broadband? And then in a car driving down the road, are you holding the meter? And so are you introducing handling noise, or is the meter sitting on something, which is, again, going to introduce rumble because it's just going to physically vibrate the mic capsules. So, you know, we could take some measurements. We could play around with some apps. It's not a terrible thing. But generally cars are, when you look at the decibel level, they're not all that different in terms of the sound pressure. It's more the quality of the noise. You know, I think that's one of the things that we talk about, and I'll talk about a little bit with one of the cars I was driving, but, you know, certain brands tend to be a little noisier. They may not measure noisier, but they have a particularly fatiguing noise quality in the way that the soundproofing lets certain frequencies through and certain ones get blocked, so... Yeah.
And, you know, I think that definitely applies to the Toyota 86 that I was just driving. You know, I think that's definitely a sound that, while it's fun for a while, I think it would be fatiguing if you were driving this all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's the Sohns versus decibels too. Like, that's a lot like horsepower in PS, right? Like, most of the power measurements now are done in PS, right?
Yeah, although, you know, PS is still measuring the same thing. It's measuring the rate of torque, basically, the rate of torque delivery. It's just a slightly different scale.
Yeah,
because it's basically metric horsepower, so metric, it's kind of like,
isn't that kilowatts?
Kind of like imperial. Well, yeah, I mean, same thing. You know, so it's measure. You know, it's like imperial gallons versus U.S. gallons.
Oh right, you know, so it's metric gallons,
or Celsius versus Fahrenheit. You know, same measurement, but you know, different scaling.
Yeah, so I'm happy to grab an app and take some sound measurements if I remember.
It'd be interesting if you could do that and compare it to the sound meter and see how accurate the apps are.
Yeah.
See how much impact that has.
The nice thing about the apps, because my sound meter is an older one. I used it actually for setting up like my mix position in audio post rooms, where you know there is a standard. You know, I wanted to mix to a 79 dB. I think it was A weighted back in the day. So I'd put on Pink Noise. I think Pink Noise. Or Pink Noise or White Noise. Well, anyway, I'd tone the room and I'd set up the mix position so that it'd have 79 dB because I was mixing for TV, not for movies. So for movies, if you're on a movie stage and you're editing, you're mixing, it's 85 dB, which if you've ever been around 85 dB, that's loud. I don't want to be exposed to that for an 8-hour stretch. So I much
prefer. Well, I mean, you know, 85 is that's the threshold that they recommend not going over.
Right. Particularly like for long-term exposure. Yeah. Like,
right.
It kind of correlates, like, give yourself a break after an 8-hour workday of, of that. And I'm like, and something like mixing, I actually tend to vary the level. So I would mark out where 79 was, because there's the way your ear works is, you know, there's the Fletcher Munson curve. So you get up at a particular sound pressure level and the frequency of response of your ear flattens out. And that's the flattest it's going to be. So did not mean to turn this into a podcast about
this week in sound geekery.
Yeah. There's a lot to it though. I'm happy to do it. I think actually one of the things that would be really cool is if, we could be a little lazy and just crowdsource a sort of a list of things that people want us to measure, within reason, please.
Yeah. We don't have test tracks at our disposal and, you know, fifth wheels and all kinds of other gear. So
yeah, but if there's something that you always go for on a car and you want us to just, you know, consistently take a look at that particular thing, you know, we can create maybe a Google Doc or something, but in the meantime, just email us and we'll get it. It's podcasts@wheelbearing.media. Wheelbearings.media.
No, actually it's feedback@wheelbearings.media.
Jesus. Okay.
It's okay. Dan's going to edit all this out. It'll never appear in the show.
Totally going to edit it.
No, don't.
Now I'm going to leave it. All right. So let's move on to actually the cars we've been driving. And Sam, right. I'll let you go first. So what's the first one you want to talk about?
The 2020 Volvo XC90 T8. And you know, it's funny, when I was scheduling cars for this month, the young lady at the fleet management company, the drive shop that was doing this one, she sent me the list and had the XC90 on there. And I thought, haven't I just recently driven this? I thought I'd driven it recently. She looked back at my schedule and said, no, you haven't been in this thing since 2016.
Wow.
So
it was brand new then.
I've been in a bunch of other Volvos. You know, the V60 and the XC60 and the XC40 and things like that. But I hadn't been in the XC90 for a while. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, it, in a lot of ways, you know, it's like all the other modern Volvos, which is mostly really good. You know, it's just bigger. It's just more, you know, the same thing, but more. And, you know, I like the look of it. You know, this generation of the XC90 is, getting towards the end of its life cycle. You know, there's a new one due for 2022. So probably about another year, 18 months, left on this one before the next generation shows up. And that next generation is the one that is going to get Volvo's new level 3 conditionally automated driving system that includes a LiDAR sensor. But that's not here yet. You know, what we have now is, you know, what we've had in other Volvos for a while. You know, so this is the plug-in hybrid, 415 horsepower total from the 2-liter four-cylinder engine in the front with both a supercharger and a turbocharger, putting out 315 horsepower, and then 100 horsepower electric motor on the rear axle and a big battery down the middle of it. And one of the things I did this time is, you know, I fully charged it up and then took it out and did, you know, did a drive cycle, a mix of, you know, urban, suburban, rural driving, a little bit of highway in there. To see how many electric-only miles I could get out of it. You know, one of the modes you can put it in is there's multiple drive modes. You can put it in sport or normal or what they call pure mode, which forces it into EV mode.
So they say you're going to get it's in metric. It's 40 kilometers, whatever that is, like 30-something miles.
Let's see. It's
times 0.6,
officially
right?
Rated at
says
18 miles.
18 miles.
The EPA... 18 miles on the window sticker. So that's the official EPA rating. I actually got 22 miles out of it.
Okay, so that's actually, which, like, that's a little closer, like, because 40 kilometers is 24 miles, right, by 0.6. So
yeah, well, I think that 40 kilometers is the WLTP number. So that's the European test value.
Well, so then you actually
a little bit higher.
You did a lot better than
yeah.
You should have.
Yeah, no, I did great. You know, and my overall average, you know, fuel economy for the week was like 99 miles per gallon because basically every time I came home, I plugged it in.
And a 400 something horsepower.
Yeah, and then, you know, but I mean, most of the time I wasn't using the 400 horsepower because you don't really need it most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, this thing, you know, if you plug it in all the time, you know, for most of your, you know, driving around town to go to the grocery store, you know, run whatever errands, you're going to be able to run it, you know, on electricity almost all the time, you know, unless you really stomp on the gas pedal and, you know, then the engine will come on and you know, you'll get plenty of performance too. But, you know, it's a nice powertrain, and this is the same powertrain that they have in the V60 plug-in hybrid, and the S60, and the XC60, and the S90, and the V90. So, you know, they basically got this across all of the 60 and 90 series models.
Well, it's like Volvo decided to take a look at its classic formula, where they had very distinctive styling, and they had one engine.
Yeah.
And they used everything.
And that's what they have today. I mean, everything that Volvo builds right now, you know, still is built around one engine, one 2-liter four-cylinder engine that they sell either with a turbocharger or a bigger turbocharger or a turbo and a supercharger or a turbo supercharger and a hybrid. You know, so that's those are your options now. Although just this week they just started production of the XC40 recharge, which is the battery electric version. So that's going to be coming soon.
Well, and Geely just introduced a vehicle that has their newest corporate architecture. So I expect that we're going to get Volvos on that architecture at some point.
Yeah, or at least Polestars. We'll probably get Volvos at some point as well. The next generation, the SPA2 architecture, which is the next generation of what's under the 60 and 90 series vehicles, that will have an option for an all-electric version. But there's also a dedicated EV platform that they've developed, which they'll be using for vehicles like, you know, upcoming Polestars. Like they also showed a concept in Beijing last week called the Polestar Precept.
Right.
And said that's going to be coming to production in about 2 years. So there's lots of electrification, lots more electrification coming from Volvo Car Group over the next several years, which, you know, is in line, excuse me, which is in line with what Volvo announced a couple of years ago when they said, you know, from 2020 onwards, all of their vehicles would have electrification. What they actually wrote in the press release was that they were going all electric, which was Not true.
Right. That's
what they actually meant was they're going all electrified, because as a standard going forward, all their models are going to have a 48-volt mild hybrid as the minimum, and then they'll have plug-in hybrids and battery electrics on top of that.
Which I think is good. And the new one that I was talking about with Geely is the SEA architecture, whatever that stands for, the Sustainable Experience Architecture.
Yeah, and I think that's what they're using for the Precept and other EV models going forward.
But I think it's good that they're going to actually have everything get a hybrid, because one of my observations with the turbo 2-liter is, well, it's a fine enough engine and it's generally powerful enough. It doesn't sound or feel as premium as it could. And so having a hybrid and the electric motor to give you that torque means you're going to have to work the engine a little less hard. And I think that will improve the character of the cars by making them feel a little bit more confident from stops and stuff like that.
Yeah. And, with the plug-in hybrids, you definitely get a lot of that, because, it'll always launch electrically, and then the engine comes in. So the engine's not working as hard. So even when the charge is depleted, when you've just got hybrid charge in the battery, it's still going to launch electrically, and then the engine comes in, unless you really stomp on it, in which case it all comes on at the same time. But, the XC90 I had was the base price for the plug-in hybrid is $67,500.
That's not terrible. Then, I mean, you compare that to what, like an X5? It's within range.
Yeah, it's not unreasonable. But then when you start adding on all the options, like this one was an Inscription, that had the really nice seats and 20-inch wheels and park assist and walnut inlays in the dashboard, and that's $6,300 for the Inscription package. The advanced package is another $2,500 for the LED headlights with active bending in the corners, and the heads up display and the 360 surround camera, and then another $3,000 for the luxury package to get the heated rear seats and the heated steering wheel, which of course you want, especially in the wintertime. And the massaging seats. Love the massaging seats. So all together, it came to $86,790 delivered. So
still not terrible when you consider the amount of luxury you get.
When you consider the luxury you get, and if you compare it to a plug-in hybrid X5, it might even be closer to an X7, because this is a three row, like the X7. You're going to be paying at least that much, for BMW or Mercedes plug-in hybrid, three row SUV as well. So it's not cheap, but it's in line with the rest of the segment. It's definitely comparable. For that kind of money, I think I might just be more inclined to go with the Aviator Grand Touring instead.
So I did drive an Aviator, and I can't remember whether I talked about it on the show or not.
You did last time.
Man, I was impressed with that thing.
Yeah.
And definitely, that was one of my comments, was like, for the same kind of money, the Lincoln actually, to me, felt a lot more premium than the Volvo. And the Volvo is nicely designed, and it's comfortable, and it does have a lot of nice features, but the Lincoln, whatever they managed to do, that thing just feels really special.
It does. So, and that's going to run you, especially a Black Label Grand Touring is going to be about $87,000-$88,000. So it's about the same price. And, it's definitely more, it feels more upscale than this one does.
So how was my consistent complaint about the XC90 is that SPA platform just doesn't seem to have a very plush ride. How was this one? Maybe I just haven't sampled it.
I wouldn't call it plush, but this one was also, with the Inscription package, you're on 20-inch wheels, and I think that always hurts ride. So it's been a long time since I drove one, that was a non-Inscription, one of the lower trim levels with the 18s or even 19-inch wheels, but I suspect the you know, some of the inputs felt a little sharp, you know, like there wasn't enough compliance in the sidewalls. You know, I mean, overall it was great. You know, it was comfortable, but I certainly wouldn't call it plush.
See, that's one of the things that the Lincoln managed to do was it had that, the one that I drove had the air suspension and so just, it could get plush.
It gives you that option of, you know, picking a softer setting, you know, or tightening it up, you know, when you want to drive more aggressively. And, you know, that adaptability that you get with that suspension system, I think is definitely an advantage.
Yeah. So, and you know, we're talking about the XC90 that's at the end of its life cycle, essentially. And so I expect that that's going to improve. So yeah. The next one will have to be better.
Yeah. And I'm sure it will be.
I mean, it's a 5-6 year old product now. It came out in 15, right? So,
yeah, I think so. Yeah. 15.
It's getting up there in age.
Yeah. You know, and this one, you know, this had the pilot assist system on there, which I tried again, and you know, it's okay. It's definitely gotten better over the years. You know, each time I've tried it, it's a little more confident. It does a little better job of, you know, staying centered in the lane. You know, it's absolutely not a system that you can do hands off. You know, not in any way, shape, or form. But you know, it does okay. You know, as a really nice driver assist system.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I like it in stop and go. It's pretty well done for that.
Yeah, it's great for that. And you know, I did do most of the driving, you know, around town with that. I didn't really go any long distances on the highway with it, so it works really well in those kinds of conditions. You know, Sensus, we've beat that one to death over the years. You know, it's going away.
Yeah.
You know, the Polestar 2 is the first one to get the new Android automotive based system, and then the new generation XC90 and everything else that follows is going to get that as well.
It's coming. It'll be here. And we'll have a new thing to complain about.
Yeah. We always find something to complain about.
Yeah, I mean, the XC90 is it's a really well done choice for its segment. You know,
yeah.
It still is, and I still think it looks fantastic.
Oh yeah, no, I mean the design. You know, it's one of those designs that holds up really well. You know, it's not a fussy design. You know, it's very clean. But it's got some really nice details in it, you know, that, you know, spread across the rest of the lineup. You know, I still like the way they've done, you know, that they did with the headlights, you know, the Thor's hammer signature lighting in the headlights. I think that's still a very cool touch that works, and it's distinctly Volvo.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. What about you?
Well, I got to try the Mazda CX-30, which I was really excited about because in the past you've driven one and your take on it was that it replaces the CX-3, which is good, but the CX-30 just slots right in between the CX-3 and the CX-5. And it's just, you know, modern Mazdas are driver's cars. Even this was a driver's car, you know, it surprised me. I had to go into the office, which is about 45 miles away, and so on the way back I have to, you know, do a couple of highway interchanges, and there's one of them that's a decreasing radius turn.
I love those.
And you shut off traction control and you're just like, I'm just gonna see how little braking I can do. And the CX-30, it doesn't matter what chassis layout it is, too. If it's a good chassis, you'll be able to do this where, yes, it's going to understeer, but then you can just balance it right on the understeer. And the CX-30 did that no problem. We got around it, and I was very pleased.
Well, you know, the thing that the CX-30 and all, you know, all the other newer Mazdas have is that G-vectoring system.
Yeah, it works.
Which, you know, it's using the accelerometer in the car, you know, and steering angle and, you know, various other sensors, and it's detecting, you know, when you're going through curves like that, and basically it automatically backs off the engine torque a little bit, which has the effect of creating some weight transfer onto the front wheels. It's essentially doing automatic trail braking for you without actually using the brakes.
Which is good because I suck at trail braking.
Yeah. And it does it really, really well and seamlessly. I mean, you can feel it, you know, just tracking wherever, you know, exactly where you want it to go without it actually feeling like it's doing anything.
Yeah, it's not impressive. It's not magic. I mean, if you overcook a turn, you're going off the side of the
road.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, physics is still physics. You know?
Right.
When I was working on ABS systems, you know, one of our, you know, the general rule of thumb was, you know, Newton was right. You know, physics ultimately wins over everything else.
Yeah. And with understeer, like, that just means, like, it understeer is safe because it plows nose first. So you get all that front impact protection. I was not able to test that, so that's a good thing, actually. But I was really pleased with just how it'll, you know, you'll get some of the body roll because Mazda's not, they know how to tune the suspension, so you get that sensation of you know, the car digging in. It'll take a set. It'll carve around that decreasing radius turn, and you know where the exact limit of adhesion is, and so you know where to sort of go, you know, steer into it and out of it, and just. That's the kind of entertainment you can do without having to go fast. And so that's really pleasant because a lot of cars these days, like that Volvo you just had, its limits are too high, you know, and I'm sure it would be unhappy if you tried to do that. But it, you know, with large wheels and big tires and there's just too much grip and you can't do that sort of thing without really being too out of control. So I appreciate that. I appreciate a car that feels elemental that way. And there was the real steering feel. It rode really well. It wasn't harsh. It had a really nice balance of sort of suppleness and you know, adhesion, I guess, or just control. And it looks great. It was that nice, like, crystal red color.
Oh, yeah. The Soul Crystal Red, yeah. That's the best color.
It looks so good. I don't know whether... I think it's like a base coat and then a tinted clear or something, too. I don't know exactly what they do to get that particular color, but it's very distinctive. And it had a light tan seats and stuff. So it really looked and felt premium. And it drove sporty. You know, it drove like BMWs used to, and I hate to use that kind of cliche, but it really does. It feels like it has that soul of a premium sort of sporty car, or just a performance mindset to it in some way. And it's not really all that fast. It doesn't have a turbo yet. It's getting the turbo, and my initial thought was it needs it. And then I thought about it, and I was like, it's going to be fine with or without it. It's not exactly slow without the turbo, but you do wind up sort of actively planning your moves a little bit sometimes.
Yeah, it's 185 horsepower.
It's
adequate.
Yeah, it's adequate, and it's really like it's enough to get in trouble. I worry that the turbo is going to have just that much more punch, and it's going to allow you to kind of upset the balance of the car. Because turbo power delivery is nonlinear, and the nice thing about this engine is that it's linear. If you want the power, you wring its neck. If if you're in the middle of a turn and you put your foot down with a turbo, especially the turbos now where they spool so quick, you've all of a sudden you've got too much torque and you're boiling the inside tire. Whereas a not naturally aspirated engine, you know you learn by feel and by hearing where that power is going to come. So it's again, if you're actively driving, you don't necessarily need it. But for the way most people drive, they're going to really appreciate the off-the-line torque and the extra performance of the turbo. And I don't think it's going to hurt CX-30. It might make it a little bit more of a challenge to drive in a irresponsible manner.
Well, you know, the turbo is the same engine that they have in the Mazda 6, the 2.5 liter turbo. So it's 250 horsepower, and it's great in the 6. I've driven it a couple of times now, and it's a really fantastic engine. Very, very smooth and seamless. You know, lots of, you know, good low end or good torque all the way through, and I think, you know, with all-wheel drive on the CX-30, and it's also going to be, it's also coming to the Mazda 3, with all-wheel drive in those models, I think it'll be fine. I don't anticipate any issues with it.
Yeah, I think it's going to make it have a good impression in the market. You know, when you consider all of its competition probably offers something that feels punchy too, mm-hmm. they kind of can't not, they can't omit it. You know, I think it compares, the CX-30 compares with the Escape, right? Or is it slightly smaller?
No, it's smaller.
Okay.
It's,
so Ford doesn't have anything that compares to it.
Well, I mean, the only thing Ford's got that's close in size to that is the EcoSport, and it really is, there's no comparison. It's not even in the same class.
No, it's definitely not. But the EcoSport is one of those other ones that's surprising. I really like to throw that thing around by the scruff of its neck, too. It's definitely not a premium feeling product.
No, not at all.
But it's surprisingly fun to fling around. So it's a little bit on the smaller side than that, and it'll have some more power. So I think it's going to occupy a niche in the market. It feels really nice. It's just a non-premium feel, which like that's a thing, you know. You don't have to go to a luxury brand to get the luxury features. It makes a good impression in the trim that I had it in, and it wasn't super expensive. It was in the 30s, but not high 30s.
It really doesn't get much over 30 fully loaded.
Yeah, and it's just pretty fully loaded. I'm not a huge fan of their infotainment. I don't mind the remote controller knob. That's fine. I just think that there's too many menus, too many clicks, and they need to sort of flatten out that structure. And the control wheel is fine. That works really well. It's just the actual software and the user interface is kind of tedious, and that makes it confusing to get what you want and go back and forth. So they got some work to do there, but the rest of the car is lovely. It's a very good size. I'm trying to think if we had everybody in it or not. At least in my use, there were no complaints about it feeling cramped, and just everything feels good and looks good. The engine, when you are sort of wringing its neck, it's a really classic Japanese four-cylinder. It's a you know, smooth, good-sounding engine, so you don't mind revving it out. Where, you know, some engines don't sound all that pleasant.
Right.
When you're doing
it. And it's not a CVT, which also helps.
Right. You know, that helps.
Six-speed, yeah.
It's a really good little compact CUV, and it doesn't matter that it's a CUV. It's still fun to drive, you know. So, and that's where we're at. Like, we're not going to stop losing sedans for crossovers. Yeah. Like, might as well just embrace
it's,
it.
It's basically a Mazda 3 hatchback that's been lifted a couple inches.
Yeah, and so come on, how can you deny that? It's a good time. And so they took that one away, and they gave me a Lexus ES350 F-Sport, which that's another one that, you know, the common complaint about the ES350 and Lexus, obviously, in general, is that the cars were a little sleepy and not really all that capable in a performance sense, or they just didn't like to be hustled. This was a little different. It doesn't mind being hustled. The F-Sport has a little stiffer suspension, a little more aggressive look, and it actually was a really good-looking car. It's comfortable. It has sportier seats, and it was blue, dark blue metallic on the outside and red leather. So, I mean, that's a nice combo. It's hard not to enjoy that. It has all of the elements kind of together, and it has that 3.5 liter V6 that snarls real nicely and has plenty of power. They've done enough on this to make it feel appropriately aggressive, and so I was surprised by that. The expected traits are still there. It's still very quiet and refined, but there's like that little bit of not too much. You kind of hear the whir of the machinery, which I appreciated that. You know, you can hear the engine a little bit more than you might think you would and it's almost like a throwback. Like there's just this little guttural sound from the V6, and it kind of thrums through the steering. I'm not saying the steering column shakes or anything. It's a solid platform. But I'm getting old, or they did a really good job on the ES 350 this time around.
Well, I wouldn't rule out that both of those are true.
That's true. I mean, it's a big city. It's based on, it's not Camry now, right? It's Avalon. Like it's all kind of the same thing, but it's bigger.
Yeah, I mean, Camry and Avalon, are both, variations of the TNGA platform. You know, the larger, they're at the larger end of that platform architecture.
Yeah. And the no problem with the room in the back seat. It was spacious, big trunk. The TNGA has always kind of impressed me. There were a couple of sort of creaks and not rattles, but it makes a little bit of noise when you're driving it, trying to exploit that performance from the big wheels and the stiffer suspension, sportier tires. I don't know that I would say that they all do that. This is a press car.
Yeah.
So they tend to sometimes get beaten.
No.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
I think too, it's one of those cars that around town, it has the right mix of performance and tuning. I think if you were to try this on a track day, you'd quickly find that it's not the car for that. You know, it's going to fall apart in terms of its performance. But it's one of those cars that on the street feels really good. Because there were a couple of times where I found the limits and I was like, oh, okay, there we go. So it's really good up until the limit. And then all of a sudden you have found them. It's not scary, but it's just, it sometimes it fools you a little bit, I guess, to just like, cause it looks so aggressive and it gives off these vibes. Like I'm a driving machine. And then,
yeah.
Then you attempt it and you're like, oh, nope. There it is. There's the understeer. We're going to be careful here. But yeah, it's a pleasant car that has a little bit of an edge to it. So, it's hard to really complain about the ES350. It's very luxurious. It's very well done. The infotainment still sucks. It did have Apple CarPlay, so that was a plus. But it's not. Their infotainment's not that well done, and I hope that they. I've been giving Toyota a pass on this for a couple of years now, saying I'm sure they're working on it. So damn it. they have to be done working on it now. They have to upgrade this stuff.
It's not good. Does the ES have the trackpad or
yes?
What's
okay. Yeah? I didn't find the trackpad terrible, but it's not as good as the old little mouse thing, the little joystick they used to have, because you can't really orient yourself on it. So there's wasted motion there, and it's. You know, when you're driving, you're trying to move the stupid highlight around to what you want, and you miss it, and there's like extra clicks. There's like three extra.
Yeah, I always thought that little mouse stubby joystick thing was a lot more precise control than what you get out of this trackpad.
Yeah, and then just the fact that like so, for example, I wanted to turn the AC off, and so you have to click into climate, and then. You can see AC and you can see that it's on, but you can't select it because you have to actually hit the bottom. There's a hard button on the bottom of the trackpad. You have to hit that, and then it brings up a sub menu, which you then can select.
You see, that's exactly wrong.
And I was like, "What? Why would you do that?
If you want to turn off AC, there should be a button, a physical button that you press off.
Yeah.
That's it.
And well, I understand here too, like they just want it to default to auto, and I get that, but
yeah. But even in most other cars, even if you have automatic climate control, there's usually one button that turns everything off, turns off the AC, the fan, everything.
I probably could have turned
it
off.
You turn it on.
But I just wanted to shut the air conditioner off. I wanted the vents still blowing. Like, it's just I'm not sure what the decision-making process is with this stuff, but it just does. I don't get it either. Like, why do I need to press three things just to do one function? Like, that's, to me, it's inexplicable. I can't understand why it's so difficult to use. And then just to go back and forth, you know, there's multiple, it has a decent sized screen, but you can get confused about, you know, what you're actually trying to select. And so I wound up having like two different nav screens up, you know, the map and the map. And it was like, what the hell?
Yeah, I've struggled with that system on multiple Lexi, and it's just not a good design.
No. And like, I'm sure you could probably use the underlying hardware and software, but you've got to clean up the user interface and make it better. Because it's just not great to use. And that's, you know, these days, that's a real selling feature of a car, especially a premium car like this. Like, somebody's going to try that car out. They're going to test drive it. They're going to plug in their device. It should come up. It should be easy to use. It should be easy to get the functions that you want. And I know that at this end of the market, too, you set everything up to your preferences, and then it becomes an extension of your other devices, too. So the car just knows what you want and does it. It's not easy to do that here. Some cars, it's really easy to set them up. This one is not. So, but to drive it was fine. It was I appreciated the driving. That 3.5 liter V6 and the automatic transmission that they have on that, man, Toyota does good powertrain.
They do. They do that well.
Well, let's keep talking about powertrain. Because the saddest news I've heard in a long time is that the Ford Mustang GT350, did I get all the names? Or is it Shelby GT350?
Shelby GT350.
Okay, so the Shelby GT350, it's ending production. So that Voodoo V8 with the flat plane crank is done. There's one final edition. You drove it, so did you try out the Heritage Edition?
We did. They brought out some Heritage Editions last week, and they did a little local drive program here near Ann Arbor over a couple of days, and got a chance to spend about 2.5 hours just tooling around in that thing, and it's glorious.
I know.
It's
I just love glorious. That car.
You know, when... Back in 2013, I was actually working for an agency that was supporting Ford Communications. And, you know, I actually wrote the press kit for the 2015 Mustang and most of the 50th anniversary of Mustang press materials over the course of 2013 and the early part of 2014 before I left there and took my current job. And somewhere around mid 2013, actually, in early 13, I had been in the design studio for, you know, for what they call an immersion, you know, where they had a group of us, and we went through a bunch of different stuff, getting a deep dive on the new car, on the 2015 car. And one of the things in the studio was the clay model of the GT350.
Yeah, don't pay attention to that.
They told us what it was, and you know they didn't get any details at the time. And you know later on, talking to somebody in engineering, you know, I learned what was special about the GT350. You know, up to that point, for the previous decade, they had been doing GT500s with a supercharged V8, which they now have again. But the GT350 was going to have a naturally aspirated V8. And at the time, I didn't know that it was going to be a flat plane crank V8. And a couple months later, I was out on Oakwood Boulevard across the street from the test track, the Dearborn Development Center, which is Ford's main proving grounds. And I saw a prototype Mustang coming out of the gate. And then I heard it as it was accelerating away. And it's like, what the... I had never heard a Mustang sound like that before.
Right.
And, you know, then when I sat down with the engineers at what was at the time still SVT, later renamed to Ford Performance, I learned all about what they had done on that engine. And, you know, there was a flat plane crank, 5.2 liter, and learned that it, you know, had a red line of 8,250 RPM. Way higher than any Mustang ever.
I know that was the thing when I drove it. I was like, because you know what a muscle car sounds like when it's time to shift. But then you realize, like, I'm not anywhere near shifting.
This thing just keeps
shifting.
On going.
Yeah. It just
yeah.
feels so weird because it basically revs like a VTEC Honda. You know?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
And it does not sound like one, though.
No. You know, and it's funny, you know, there are other flat plane crank V8s, you know, usually in high performance European cars.
Yeah, the M3 had one. The what was it? The E46 M3 or E90? E90 M3 had one, I think.
Is it the E90? Yeah, the E92 M3 had a flat plane crank V8. And so, you know, they tend to have a very distinctive sound that's quite unlike a typical V8 engine. Although the one in the Mustang, the Voodoo V8, as they called it, was different, was a little bit different from those because it had a different firing order from what you typically get on most flat plane crank V8s. And so it still has a little bit of that classic, you know, big V8 rumble mixed in with that higher pitched sound from revving. And it just sounds amazing. And this is the thing, you know, I know we're going electric, you know, everything's going to be electric. And, you know, they're going to be faster than this thing. I mean, hell, the Mustang Mach-E GT is going to be faster than a GT350, you know, from 0-60 and quarter mile.
And we'll talk about that. Right.
But it's not the same.
It doesn't matter.
You miss that visceral feeling of the sound and the vibration. You know, I mean, V8s are smooth, but they're still at idle. They have that little bit of
that one little
first
bump.
Order. Yeah, that little rumble, and it feels like it's alive. And you don't get that from EVs. I remember back in 2008 when I first drove the Tesla Roadster for the first time, and the same thing. You know, it's incredibly fast and great handling and everything, but it's quiet and it's like something's missing. You know,
yeah.
And you know, you don't want a synthetic sound, or you know, you don't want a synthesized version of a naturally aspirated engine in that case, I don't think. But
no, I actually I like the wail. I like to hear the wail of the engine and the motor, the inverter,
yeah,
all of that hardware, and you get to hear the gearbox too. So I think
yeah.
they could just go straight cut gears.
Yeah,
and well, make a shitload of noise.
And that's what they do on the Formula E race cars.
Oh, do you know, they straight cut them?
Straight cut gears. That's what makes the Formula E cars sound so cool. They sound like TIE fighters.
Yeah, they just
Star
wail.
Wars.
Yeah.
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 you know, and they actually sound really cool.
Yeah.
But you don't usually get that in street cars. But anyway, the GT350 is coming to an end. You know, they're in production now with the GT500. The 350 is done this week. They should be building out the last of them. The last of them should be rolling off the line in Flat Rock either this week or early next week. They'll finish up the last handful of them. And this last batch that they built are what they call the Heritage Edition. They decided, you know, they were coming to the end of the line. They wanted to do the same livery that was on the original GT350s back in 1964, which was Wimbledon white. The same kind of slightly off-white shade that they had as the standard color on the regular Mustangs at the time, and with these Guardsman blue stripes over the top and along the rocker panels. And the thing is, Ford wanted to replicate that Guardsman blue. They knew how to do Wimbledon white because they've done that on various special edition Mustangs over the years, including the 2015 50th anniversary edition. But They never actually had painted Guardsman blue because those were painted at Shelby American out in California, out in Venice, when they were being built.
Yeah, who knows?
So Ford
was in that paint.
Ford had no paint master yeah. for it, but they went out to the Shelby archives in Las Vegas at Shelby American, and they actually found the paint master for Guardsman blue, and they brought it back to Michigan, and they managed to get it matched. They got a match for it, and the company. The stripes on the GT350 are actually vinyl. They're not painted on. So the company, their supplier for those stripes, they worked with them and went through a few iterations and finally got a perfect match of the stripes with the paint master. And they actually brought out a 65 GT350, you know, had it parked next to it, and you can see that it was the same color. The other main thing that they changed on the Heritage Edition is the Cobra badges on the tail, the grill, and on the instrument panel. Traditionally, those are red. On all the other GT350s, they've been red. For this one, they actually made them Guardsman blue, so it matches the stripes. But other than that, it's you know, basically standard GT350, and they were available either as the base GT350 or the 350R. I actually got to drive a 350R for a couple hours, and which is great because that's got the carbon fiber wheels on it and the really nice Recaro seats and everything.
Yeah, the one I drove was a 350R, I think, yeah. And it's been a few years. That's the only press car I've driven that I had somebody pull up to me at a light and ask me to rev it up. Yeah. And of course, I had it in like, you know, completely open, you know, as open as you can get most. You could hear the thing. And I was like, absolutely. This sounds so good. God, I love that car.
if you ever have a chance to drive a GT350, what you need to do is like take it in a parking garage,
yeah,
or drive under a stone railroad bridge like I did a couple of times. The place where we're driving, there's this old stone railroad bridge, and you know, rev the shit out of it as you're going under this, and just feel that echo off the stones,
and the snaps
or drive
and
it through a tunnel. Yeah.
It'll a little overrun.
It's fabulous.
It's one of those cars, and I'm sad that it's going away. I understand why it is. And I'm sure the GT500 is performance-wise better. But I'm just
it's faster.
Yeah, faster isn't everything.
That's what I was about to say. I don't know that I would necessarily say it's better, cuz it's also heavier.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a bit heavier. The GT500 is by far the best GT500 they've ever built. You know, unlike the past, you know, this is the first one with the independent suspension and everything. And it's definitely a better handling car, but it is, like 400 pounds heavier than the GT350R.
Yeah, that's a lot.
The 350R, even with those massive brakes that are on it, is 3,700 pounds. And the GT500 is about 4,100 pounds.
Woo! That's 4,100 pounds. That's only a couple hundred pounds lighter than our Grand Cherokee.
Yeah.
Which I do not want to drive around like that. You know.
But you know, if you put a big supercharged V8 in that Grand Cherokee, the Trackhawk, you know, you're up closer to 5,000 pounds too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably more than that, right?
Yeah.
With all the other stuff they put in there, but that's the thing though. Like, the numbers are just it's. They're pointless because it's the way that car just, it's the way it shakes. Honestly, it just like has that heartbeat, you know, everything sort of sympathetically vibrates with that engine, and the way it sounds and everything is just, it makes it an experience. And the lighter weight with 3,700 pounds is not exactly light, but
no.
These days it's fine. But the way it's going to handle, and the way you can manage the mass and sort of, you know, throw it around a little bit like that. It was just a sports car, not a Mustang. You know what I mean? Like it had finally sort of really come into its own. It was just enough engine, and just enough, adhesion, and more chassis than engine, I think, which was sort of kind of the flip side of Mustangs for so long.
Right. Well, and that was always the balance, you know, back in the 60s between the 350 and the 500. You know, the 350 was the small block engine that was the car that was designed to go SCCA road racing.
Yeah.
And, you know, won a bunch of championships. The 500 was the drag car. That's the one you took to the strip, you know, and that eventually evolved, you know, into the Cobra Jet, you know, which was the pure, you know, factory drag racing car.
Yeah.
So, you know, those were the 500s were the big blocks back in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, think about that. A Falcon with an FE big block in it. Like, that's just not a car that, like, there's no way to make that actually handle very well.
No. And they didn't. They were terrible. but they could go in a straight line, nothing else.
Fine. Not although my thing.
But, you know, compared to today's GT500s, you know, it was a dog. You know,
well, yeah.
Even with that big block, you know, it was only about, in SA gross horsepower, probably somewhere around between 350 and 375 horsepower.
Yeah, but at most it weighed like 3,000 pounds too. Like the Falcon.
Like, well, those big blocks are pretty heavy. Those were cast iron blocks.
Yeah, but the rest of the car was like 13 pounds. There was nothing to them. Yeah. I think so. Even though, like, I almost want one of the old ones with the big block in it, even though it's going to be so terrible, just because it's going to be terrifying. And so you'll at least feel something.
It's terrifying, all right. I drove one in December when I was out in Vegas for the GT500 drive. They had a 68 GT500 out there that Haggerty brought out. And, it looked great, but, compared to driving a modern car, you know, it was terrible. I mean, you know, all kinds of slop in the steering wheel and halfway through the brake pedal travel before much of anything happens.
And, and it's all drums.
Yeah. No, it had discs on the front.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
But that's sort of the thing. Like, you get all this cold competence, and I feel like the GT350 had that balance of, like,
it still had a bit of raw edge to
it. Yeah, and I like that in a car.
But it's not all bad. I mean, in the spring, they're going to have the Mach 1 is going to be available, which, you know, is not quite a 350. You know, it kind of cuts, you know, kind of a blend between a GT and a GT350. So it has the regular 5-liter cross-plane crank V8, but it's up to, I think, 485 or 490 horsepower. And, you know, it doesn't quite have the look of the GT350, but, you know, it'll still be plenty of fun.
Can we really complain about the Mustang?
No.
Like, we're splitting hairs here, and yes, it's a very special car. We very much liked the engine. It's neat. There's not really much to complain about with the cross-plane V8 or anything like that. Is that still the Coyote? It's the Coyote, right? Like the
it's based on the Coyote block, but it's a modified version of the block. Bigger bores, and it has the plasma coated bores on it, like the GT500s do. So instead of steel liners in there, it's aluminum liners with a plasma coating on there to give it the durability it needs to rev to 8,250 RPM.
Yeah, that's a good time. So I think it's more of just like a thank you, Ford, for building it for a couple of years. And I honestly, I don't know how it sold. Like, that might be the other thing too. It's like, they're like, we're done losing money on this thing.
I don't think they lost money on it. They sold several thousand a year, over its run, which was good. And you know, one of the things that was explained to me was, you know, back in 2007, when they relaunched the GT500, prior to that, they had the SVT Cobra. So on the S197 Mustangs, the old the previous generation, they had, or rather, on the SN95s. The GT500 was the S197. On the SN95s, it was called the supercharged high end version was just the SVT Cobra. And one of the things that they learned from that program is, while people liked them, they didn't actually get any extra profit margin on them. You know, it was like a couple hundred dollars extra profit margin on them versus selling a GT. So they were at a higher price point, but the gap between the cost and the revenue was, you know, was not much different. One of the things they learned was, when they put a Shelby badge on it, they could charge a lot more money. People would pay a lot more money for the same car with a Shelby badge.
Shelby noticed that, like, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they sell those at a much higher profit margin than they do, you know, standard Mustangs. So they certainly made money on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, good for them. You know, it's not like it's bad for us anyway. They're still coming out with cool stuff.
Yeah.
I think our point with the GT350, GT500 conversation was that, you know, like, the numbers are kind of, they're not as material as you would think. And with electric vehicles, I think that one of the things that every time there's a new electric vehicle out there, new EV comes out, A, it's a luxury car, and B, they talk about how scorchingly quick it gets to 60 miles an hour. Like, you know, this one does it in like a half a second. It's such nonsense. The numbers don't matter when to 60. Like, we've proven that yes, they have lots and lots of torque and they can get it to the ground very effectively. So what?
My point exactly. I wrote a post on our company blog at guidehouseinsights.com. And, you know, it's gotten so ridiculous. You know, with something like the GT350, I wasn't driving it anywhere near its limits, and I still had a ball with it. It didn't need to be as powerful as it was. You know, it was 525 horsepower. It didn't need to be that powerful. Just my personal car, my Miata, certainly nowhere near that. You know, it was like 116 horsepower when it was new 30 years ago. Who knows what it is now? I found my old performance timer and stuck it on there and went out and did some 0-60 runs, and it was about 9.5 seconds.
And that's plenty.
It doesn't matter because it's so much fun to drive. EVs, you know, starting with the Tesla Roadster, you know, one of the things that Tesla did with the Roadster was demonstrate that EVs could be fun. You know, they didn't have to be, you know, this, you know, slow appliance, you know, a golf cart. They proved that it could be an exciting car. And the Roadster, you know, did 0-60 in 4 seconds.
4 seconds to 60 is, like, that's Corvette C6 fast. That's fast.
Yeah, it's really fast. So, you know, what we're seeing now, you know, with some of these high-end EVs is just getting absurd. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago about Lucid and the launch of the Lucid Air. And at the time, they said one of the things they were claiming was, you know, this thing would go run a quarter mile in 9.9 seconds, you know, which is, I mean, that's Dodge Demon numbers, you know, for a luxury four-door sedan.
Somebody's just going to plow that into like a Starbucks.
Yeah.
So, like,
And, you know, we've been seeing, you know, from Tesla for several years now with the Model S and the Model X and the Y, and we've seen Faraday Future claiming that they're quicker, you know, getting into like the low 2 second range, 0-60. You know, that is just ridiculously fast. We don't need cars that go that fast, you know, unless you're planning to take these things to a track. And that's the only place where you should be using that kind of performance is on a track. There's no way you should be accelerating that fast on public streets. It's totally irresponsible. And I'm somebody that likes to drive fast. And I don't do that kind of nonsense when especially if there's anybody around. You know, we don't need EVs to be that fast. I remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a controversy in Europe because a lot of high-end German cars, you know, were getting, you know, they were approaching top speeds of 200 miles an hour, you know, when they had cars like the original AMG Hammer and some of these other ones. And the German government actually threatened to impose speed limits on all of the Autobahn. And so the industry actually came together and said, okay, look, don't do that. Don't do the speed limits on the Autobahn. We will voluntarily agree to limit the top speed of our cars to 155 miles an hour, 250 kilometers per hour.
And they did until you took it to somebody like AMG, which then would remove the speed limit.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, they at least did something.
Yeah.
And I think it's time, you know, for EV makers, you know, now, you know, last week at the Tesla Battery Day, you know, Musk talked about, you know, the Model S Plaid, you know, which is going to be a three-motor version of the Model S. There's also a three-motor version of the Lucid Air. You know, the day before, or a couple of days before Battery Day, they took it to Laguna Seca and, you know, set a record for, you know, a four-door production intent car. And, you know, did quarter mile in 9.2 seconds with this thing.
Jesus.
And, you know, then the Model S Plaid went even faster. Okay, you've made your point. These things are faster than we could make any production internal combustion cars. Frankly, I don't think we should be making internal combustion cars that fast either. You know, 1,500 horsepower Bugatti Chirons is just, it's stupid. It's idiotic. And I think that we need to back off and stop putting so much emphasis on the acceleration performance of these things, because the reality is most drivers cannot handle that level of performance.
They haven't done the training. It's still rare for a car to be that quick. I wouldn't want to try to exploit that kind of performance. And you know, I've driven a lot of high performance cars. 0 to 60 that fast is like that's fast. And you know, something that's going to be able to get up to 130, 140 miles an hour without much of a problem, that's really fast.
Yeah.
And well, unless you do it a lot, you do not have enough practice to understand how quickly you're on top of things, how tiny your inputs need to be to not upset the car. Like, no, don't do it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's only getting worse. I mean, Lotus is about to launch the production version of the Avaya, their first electric car. You know, they've been going through final validation testing recently. And this, you know, they're only going to build 130 of these, and they're going to cost $2 million. And it's got 2,000 horsepower. That's why?
Fine. Why? I mean, you know, so here's the thing
In the case of the Avaya, most of those are going to end up being garage queens anyway. They're never going to get driven.
Which is a shame.
But, yeah.
Because I'm sure they're actually going to drive really well because they're a Lotus.
Yeah.
The thing that I just come back to is like, these are about energy efficiency, but they're not really. Like, I think it's great that it's been proven that they can be fun, they can be desirable, they can be a different niche in the market. Great. All of that is really good because it's created demand and it's created conversation, and like, these are all good things. But what if you just backed off the performance a little bit? you could be more efficient.
Yeah. The reality is, yeah, you know, certainly, you know, Lucid's done a lot to improve efficiency. Tesla's, you know, doing a lot for efficiency. You know, that's great. But, you know, you're certainly not going to achieve that efficiency when you're using that level of performance. You know,
right.
to get that, you know, to get 500 miles of range, you know, you're not going to accelerate to 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. You know, when you do that, you're going to get closer to 100 miles of range. But, you know, at this point, it's really more about the leaders of these companies. You know, it's a measuring contest,
right.
And I'm not talking about measuring the speed of the vehicles.
Yes, I mean, well, and it takes a certain kind of person. I'm using the word "person" is just staying in for whatever, but it takes a certain kind of person to be the figurehead for one of these companies. Partially because I think the paradigm was set with Tesla, where you have this kind of demagogue at the head of the company. And we've seen some other ways of doing it. You know, Lucid, for example, is a sort of an all-star team of experienced professionals. But, you know, Rivian and Nikola, they both sort of have their own guy at the, you know, at the top who's sort of...
Well, Nikola's, you know, Trevor Milton's gone now. But.
Well... Yeah, I don't know enough about
story.
That situation. It just sounds really messy and whatever. But you know, like, that's the thing. There's an EV company, and then there's the person who's at the top, who is sort of like the mastermind, right? And that needs to go away, quite honestly.
Yeah.
Like, because it's more of that, like, that hero complex thing, right? Like, it's a sort of tech leaning paradigm, like Steve Jobs at Apple or
the cult of personality.
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect way to put it. And I'm all set with that. I think a lot of people are. We could just give us good products and products that don't use a lot of energy in any way. You know, like, you still have to put the electricity in the batteries. So try to keep as much in the battery for as long as possible. It only holds, like, what, 3 gallons of gas worth of energy? I mean, you know, come on. Try to do a good job with that. So I'd be really curious to see, like, if we said, hey, we're going to make an EV. It's going to cost $35,000. It's going to go 0 to 60 in 9-10 seconds. But it's you know, it's going to go 500 miles. Like, I think that's something we could probably do or get to pretty easily.
You could even do, you know, faster than that, you know, 0 to 60 in 6 seconds, you know, or even 5 seconds is fine. You know, a Chevy Bolt, you know, will do 0 to 60 in about 6.5 seconds.
That's pretty quick.
And that's quick.
Yeah.
That's plenty quick enough, you know, and you know, for higher end cars, you know, do it in 5 seconds. That's not crazy. That's not unreasonable. I think that's perfectly acceptable. You know, beyond that, yeah, and this goes for internal combustion cars too. I think we need to start backing off on some of the performance and focus on other areas.
Yeah, I think actually it goes more for internal combustion cars because the you can't, you know, with an EV, it's just kind of like a rheostat where like if you're not using it, you're not using it. But you can't really dial back. You can use like cylinder deactivation and stuff on an internal combustion engine and sort of dial it back, but there's no way to make it as efficient as an EV when you're not using all the potential, you know? So yeah, definitely. Like I'm okay with slower cars that are more fun to drive, you know, make them lighter, make them, mm-hmm. make them smaller, make them slower. It's fine. Like it's like, I mean, the CX-30, it was not all that fast, but I had a really good time in it. Miata is a perfect example too. So, yep. This episode has been sponsored by Mazda.
They released all the specs, finally on the powertrains for the new 2021 F-150. Which we'll be driving in early November. They've launched production. They've started production in Dearborn, and about 4 weeks from now, I'll have the first drive of that. And this generation is the first one to have a hybrid powertrain, which they, for a couple of years now, they've been talking about. You know, they're doing things a little bit different with this hybrid. They're really focusing on people that are using these things as a truck. So the goal was to not sacrifice capability, but to enhance capability while still, you know, maintaining good fuel economy. So it's not designed for, you know, ultimate, you know, fuel economy, but to give you good fuel economy while still being able to tow 12,700 pounds. And have a payload of 2,100 pounds in this thing, which is really impressive. You know, it's slightly less than what you get with the 5-liter V8, you know, which does 13,000 pound towing, or the standard 3.5-liter EcoBoost, which is 14,000 pounds towing. The PowerBoost, you know, combines the EcoBoost V6 with an electric motor that is, it's Ford's modular hybrid design. So the motor sits in between the engine and the torque converter. Or is it?
It's somewhere.
I can't remember if the torque converter is before or after the electric motor. But anyway, it's in the transmission.
That's interesting. I was going to say, I would assume it's after it, because if you put it before, you've got to drive through, you've got to lose efficiency through the torque converter, right?
Yeah. So it's engine, torque converter, and then electric motor, and then the transmission. And one of the cool features that they have with this is, you know, electric power generation from this thing. So the standard with the power boost is 2.4 kilowatt power output for to power tools at a work site. Or anywhere else, you know, power any equipment that electrical equipment that you want. And then the optional upgrade is 7.2 kilowatts, including a 240-volt outlet.
Run your dryer.
Yeah. Well, you can run your dryer, or, you know, for contractors, you know, you can run a welder off of that, you know, a lot of other equipment. And what this does, because this setup is more efficient compared to, you know, a lot of contractors, they will take a gas generator, you know, they'll haul around a gas generator in their truck, take that to a job site and use that to power their tools and, you know, charge up their tools. You know, those tend to be dirtier, you know, they don't have emission controls on them. They're not as fuel efficient. This is going to be much more fuel efficient. Even if you deplete the battery and you've got the engine running, it's still going to be a cleaner, more efficient setup than running a gas generator.
And it's quiet. So, oh my God, it's so much more quieter. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, this is going to be a pretty impressive setup, you know, for anybody that needs power to power other equipment. You know, and I think that it's going to be a very appealing configuration. And it's less than $2,000 premium over the base, the standard 3.5-liter EcoBoost.
If what I've seen from truck prices holds true lately, though, this is going to be like a $45,000 base price truck.
I went through the configurator, you know, because you can actually get this like on the lower, like on the XLT.
Oh, do they have the built-in price up? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's available now, and I went through it. You can actually get the hybrid, you know, for in the low $40,000 range. I think it might even be less than that. Which, you know, it's funny, you know, back in the late 2000s, 2007, 8, 9, when GM introduced their two-mode hybrid on their full-size SUVs and on the pickup trucks, you know, at that time, that system was a $20,000 price premium.
It was very really expensive.
Actually, the price premium was not 20. It was about 10 grand, but the cost to GM was about $20,000.
GM has this habit of shooting themselves in the foot with the Sierra C3 was the same thing, where it had that rear wheel steering, and they eventually like sold them off for less than the price of just the parts to build it, because they're like, yeah, whatever, we can't make money on that thing. So hopefully they do better.
Yeah.
On the
You know, this one, it should do pretty well. I think it's going to be a popular option for customers that need this kind of capability. You know, certainly, you know, if you're towing 12,500 pounds with this thing, you're not going to get 23 miles per gallon, which is what it's rated at. But you know, it should still do pretty well.
Yeah. I just like how thoughtful Ford has been with all of their updates to this particular generation. You know, the 2021 F-150 really sounds like Ford is aggressively protecting its biggest moneymaker, which they absolutely should. But they're making really significant, thoughtful improvements that will please the people who use the trucks, you know, in a wide variety of ways. And I saw a hilarious story that to test it, the engineers took like a stove and a bunch of stuff down to like a camping facility or something, and they had all this electrical stuff in the back of the truck, which I thought, that's great. That's you know, so there's the contractor use for the upgraded, you know, with the 220 volt and stuff. You know, is there really a practical use for that for the casual buyer of the F-150? Because there's a lot of those buyers too. Like, what would compel you to buy that?
Probably not.
Yeah.
I would think you're probably it's, you know, if what you're looking for is the best fuel efficiency, you're actually better off with the 2.7-liter EcoBoost. I think that's actually the most it depends. If you're towing, your best fuel efficiency option is going to be the 3-liter diesel. That's a good engine.
Oh my god,
that's a great engine, and it's the one that, you know, when you're towing, you're not going to lose all. You know, it's still going to have decent fuel economy even when you're towing. You know, you can tow, you know, 10,000 pounds with that and still be getting 25 miles per gallon. Whereas, you know, you do that with an EcoBoost V6, and you're getting about 14 or 15 miles per gallon. For just the average person, you know, if you're not towing all the time, if you're, you know, doing occasional towing or, you know, just hauling stuff in the bed, the 2.7-liter EcoBoost is probably the best option. That's going to get you the best combination of fuel economy and, you know, price and, you know, affordability and capability. And then, you know, the hybrid is really, if you need, you know, that really high-end towing capability and the power takeoff capability, that's where you're going to get the advantage there.
Yeah, they have a lot of choices. I'm just looking at it now. So the standard engine is a 3.3-liter V6, which I didn't realize they made.
Yeah, that, you know, they don't, you know, those are mostly sold to fleets that want the cheapest possible truck.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Not too many consumers buy those.
And then they've got the Nano, the 2.7, the 3.5, and the
The 2.7 is the most popular option.
Yeah, which makes sense. That's such a good engine. It's so punchy and it is pretty efficient. So the hybrid is really like in an XLT, like a crew cab. It's about $45,000 starting price for the hybrid because it's 42,650 for the crew cab. And it's a 47,145 with the hybrid. So,
yeah, you can get an XL with the hybrid.
XL with the hybrid, okay.
Yeah, for like 43,500.
So it's priced very aggressively. You know, there's so many options in Truckville.
Yeah,
that you can get exactly what you want. So somebody was asking me today too. When is the Super Duty coming? I didn't have an answer other than like, well, we're probably going to ride 2021.
They just did a mid-cycle update on the Super Duties for 2020.
Yeah, if they did a mid-cycle for 2020, then we're probably not going to see them till like 2023 or 24. Right?
Yeah, I would think 2023 probably.
Yeah, so I thought they'd been a little bit sooner. I thought we might see them in 21 as 22s, but.
I think it'd probably be 22 as a 23 model year. Yeah. So late 22. So a couple of years from now.
They're not bad trucks though.
No.
I liked I had an F-350 a while ago and it was not gnarly even though it had a, you know.
Yeah, and you know, they just got that new 7.3 liter gas engine in the Super Duties and they still have the 6.7 liter diesel, so.
Yeah. Trucks are where there's that sort of all the emphasis right now. Everything else is kind of slacked off. So, all right. Did we have any? We did have some questions from Twitter. Any others?
We had a couple of email questions. First one is from Tristan Ollie. Tristan says, big fan of the show. Really enjoy how in-depth you go on the industry as opposed to just talking about 0-60 times. Rebecca has been a great addition and I enjoy the different points of view you bring from your experience in the industry. My question for all of you is, what is the future of the manual transmission with most brands planning to electrify their entire lineups? Every vehicle I've ever owned has been a manual, starting with my 1993 Toyota Celica. Will we see hybrid cars with manuals? Having the fun of a manual with some extra fuel economy sounds like a win. I know the CRZ was available with a manual. Is there a technical reason newer cars could not use a similar setup, or just the market for such a vehicle is too small? Well, Tristan, unfortunately, the answer is there is no future for manual transmissions.
I think, though, because the market is too small.
Yeah, exactly. And really, you know, with electric vehicles, you don't even really need a transmission at all. I mean, most EVs just have a single speed setup, which is nothing more than a reduction gear, you know, to get you down from, you know, the electric motors run at much higher speeds than the wheels need to turn. So you basically just have a reduction gear set on there, which is, you know, essentially just the final drive. So not really a transmission at all. There's a few, like the Porsche Taycan actually has a two-speed transmission on the rear axle and a single speed on the front axle, which theoretically can get you a little better efficiency. Because you can get the motor running more in its sweet spot, but you know, for the most part, you're not going to see manual transmissions with electrics, and even with hybrids, you know, most hybrids don't even use. The CRZ was like the last hybrid, the last hybrid with a manual. You know, the first generation Insight also offered a manual.
Yeah, well, I think the CRZ was kind of an extension of that integrated motor.
It was, yeah, kind of
set. And it wasn't. It wasn't awful to drive, but it wasn't great either. It was not sporty. CRZ kind of sold itself as something that it wasn't. It's still, it's a fun car. It's a nice curiosity, but yeah, I think that you really just the manual transmission is a thing from the past. It's fun to drive. It's a thing that, you know, we all take pride in mastering. Think about it now. It's not that hard. We all mastered it when we were teenagers, right?
There is another thing about manual transmissions as well. And one of the reasons why manufacturers have moved away from them, besides just the lack of demand from consumers, it used to be that manual transmissions would get better fuel economy than automatics. And that's no longer the case with modern automatic transmissions that have, you know, 7, 8, 10 gears and electronic controls. Now, you know, they manage the engine and the transmission together, and they can really optimize, you know, the operation of the two to maximize fuel economy, at least on, you know, the test cycles. But even real world, you can usually get better fuel economy with a modern automatic transmission than you can with a manual, just because it shifts much more precisely, much faster than, you know, than you can shift a manual. And it's because it's, you know, it's operating in its sweet spot more of the time. You're just never going to be able to match that with a manual transmission. And that's part of why manufacturers have moved away from them.
Yeah. I mean, manuals are like, it's a reactive thing, right? Like for the emissions. And that's one of the reasons actually why a modern manual is kind of unpleasant to drive. When we get them in media cars, they're not like the old manuals. You know, there's a lot of electronics going on. And so it's actually kind of hard sometimes to drive certain vehicles with a manual transmission smoothly, because it's feathering the throttle for you. It's messing with the clutch, and the emissions need to be so tightly controlled that, you know, you can't just dump it into third gear. I mean, you can, but, you know, you dump it into third gear and, you know, short shift, and it's not like it used to be.
There's a lot of stuff happening between your right foot and the engine.
Yeah,
you know, and the cylinders, that is out of your control.
Yeah, there's a lot of filter.
Yeah,
and so that makes it less pleasant and less rewarding than it used to be. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, we'll probably see transmissions stick around on EVs as we start going for, you know, more and more range and efficiency. Like, that's a way to achieve that. But, you know, Tesla had a problem with their first with the Roadster, right? It was supposed to have a 2-speed gearbox, and they never got that working right. So.
They had a tendency to break after about 1,000 miles or so.
Yeah, that's no good.
And
they're not the only ones. Like, it's a tricky thing, you know. A gearbox that can stand up to that kind of torque is electric motors. They can give you all the torque you want.
Instantly.
And that's why you don't really need a transmission so much anymore. You know, it's not a bad thing though, because you wind up with a less complex vehicle, less stuff to break, and less expensive, which, you know, goes into the batteries, which are more expensive.
Yeah.
I don't know. So unfortunately, I agree. I think the market for manuals is going away. So hang on to your car, whatever you're driving now. Hang on to it if it has a manual.
All right. Next up, Joshua Brentano is asking, we have 2 young kids and we're approaching the age where we can start some extended road trips. So it's time for a minivan. Yay. I have 2 questions. We want it fully loaded. What is your recommendation for a fully loaded minivan? I've looked over and over at the offerings from all the manufacturers and they all seem sort of similar. I feel like I'm always narrowing it down to Honda and Chrysler, but I'm open to your expertise. We may very well be replacing my dad's, question number 2, we may very well be replacing my dad's 3-series BMW, so it'd be awesome if I could soup it up. I'm assuming he's referring to the minivan. Dad would like to be, would like it to be fun to drive and cool to look at. LOL. Do any of these makes have any kind of decent aftermarket or performance parts for minivans? Thanks for a fun and informative show, Joshua. So, you know, I mean, there's no longer a whole lot of options for minivans. You're basically down to 4. The Chrysler Pacifica, the Honda Odyssey, Toyota Sienna, which is all new for 2021, and the Kia Sedona, which is also getting a redesign for 2021. Certainly, you know, we haven't tried out the new Sienna yet. You know, I have a feeling that it's going to feel very much like the new Highlander, which is fine. You know, it's certainly not something that I would call sporty or fun, but it's, you know, it's effective. To be honest, I wouldn't call any of these particularly sporty or fun, but you know, they're designed for a task, which is to move people and stuff, and you know, do it very effectively. You know, the Honda, the Odyssey, and the Pacifica are both excellent at doing that job.
I think my pick for like an actual practical family van would be the Pacifica. Because it really does. It comes down to those two, the Odyssey and the Pacifica, because the Sienna is not here yet. And I don't know, it's been forever since I was last in Sedona, but it looks better than it drives.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as aftermarket stuff, I looked around earlier today and didn't really find any aftermarket performance stuff of these.
Yeah, I think anything for most things for an Accord would probably fit the Odyssey. And there's some JDM stuff, right? Like there's just some people who modify the Odyssey. I don't think there's any enthusiasm for the Pacifica in the aftermarket at all.
Yeah, Mopar does make a bunch of accessories, appearance-wise for the Pacifica. You can certainly soup up the looks a little bit, but you're not really going to find any performance stuff for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you don't want it.
Yeah. Not in a minivan.
The Odyssey, from what I've observed, hits a midlife crisis around 110,000-130,000 miles, where just like there's some expensive stuff that needs fixing. On those, I don't know what the Pacifica is like, so you should definitely, if you plan to keep it for a very long time and get all your money out of it, check out sort of the long-term reliability. But try several different sites or whatever, because like Consumer Reports, I don't know that enough Consumer Reports readers buy Chryslers. They tend to be very loyal to Toyota and Honda, so I don't know that there's enough data there. So to look around and see what kind of data you might find about sort of long-term ownership experience, and bear that in mind, because what parent wants to be taking a loss on the thing in 3 years when you have college funds to raid?
one thing you might want to consider, since you're probably not going to have any real performance options, is the Pacifica Hybrid, which is a plug-in hybrid with like 32, 33 miles of electric range.
It's awesome.
And for your around-town driving, if you plug it in at night, unplug it in the morning, you can basically do most of your driving completely on electricity without ever using any gas. Then when it's time for those road trips, and are you really sure you want to do that? But when it comes time for those road trips, you don't have to really plan, where you're going to stop for charging, like you would if it was a pure EV. You just drive it like a hybrid, and it gets really good fuel economy even, in hybrid mode. So that's something to consider. Also, the 2021 Pacifica that's launching imminently, it's getting a mid-cycle update. It's going to be one of the first FCA vehicles to get their new Uconnect 5 infotainment system, which is thoroughly updated, much, much improved from Uconnect 4.
Yeah, I think I got a walkthrough of that back a couple of months ago, and I was impressed with how thoughtful they were about it and how they, they did listen to user feedback and adjusted touch targets, and there's a lot of customization you can do with it, and so that will be a good upgrade.
Yeah. Both of them offer a lot of features. You've got lots of USB ports all around for charging devices, so the kids, if they've got tablets or laptops or something, or games that they want to play, they can keep those charged so they're not pestering you too much. You've got, lots of space in there for, all of the essentials that you have to take along when you're hauling kids along with you. So, I think either one of them would be an excellent choice.
I think honestly, like the Pacifica is the one I would choose. I just think it has the best combination of features. It's the best priced out there. I think you're just likely to get a better deal on it. It looks better. It drives better. Well, the Honda has a little bit of sportiness to it, but it's I don't know. I think as an overall package, the Pacifica is really, really tough to beat. The hybrid, you do miss out on Stow and Go, but if you don't get the hybrid, you get the Stow and Go seats, which is nice. But that, I don't know that that's a deal breaker without them. And it's just, you know, they know what they're doing with the van, and that's a really well done van. And kids love vans. If you haven't put your kids in a van, because, you know, most cars these days are tanks. They can't see out of them. My kids lost their minds the first time we had a minivan as a media loan. Because you put them in it and you put their seats in there, you know, and you latch
and they can actually
in.
See out.
Yeah, because they're big windows in the side. They were like, this is awesome. So, yeah, do it and enjoy yourself. It's hard to buy a bad van, but
The other great thing about minivans is sliding doors.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, if you're putting those kids into booster seats, you know, the sliding doors are just so infinitely superior to conventional hinged doors on an SUV. Yeah, because first of all, you know, it's not up. It's generally not up as high. So it's easier for you to handle the kids getting in and out. You know, they can move around easier. You know, if they're getting into the third row, it's easier to maneuver around in there than in a typical SUV. One of the nice things about the Odyssey that is unique to the Odyssey is the second row. You can actually move the seats side to side.
Oh, that's right. The magic slide seat or whatever they call it.
Yeah. So, you know, you can, you know, if you've got two kids, you know, so, you know, if you need to have them physically separated.
Why would they ever need to be physically separated?
You know, you can have the seats pushed out to the sides and have a walkthrough to the third row. Or, you know, if they, you know, want to play a game together or something, you can slide either one of them over to the other side and put them side by side. So you have a bunch of different options in there. So that's definitely something to consider with the Honda.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let us know what you get. The Pacifica, if you buy the, like, a high end one too, with the screens, it has games on the screens.
Yes. They've got built in games. So.
Which, you know, keeps the peace for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
All right, so we had a couple of Twitter questions. One of them was just a suggestion to basically attack each other over nothing, but this is not Fox, so we won't be doing that. Let's see. DLevine61 says, is my lust for a 68-69 Thunderbird with a 428 wrong? I don't find anything wrong with that. Do you have any thoughts, Sam?
If that's your thing, you know, if you like, you know, big, heavy, big blocks, you know,
in big, heavy, big cars.
Yeah. That, you know, that can't really go around corners, but, you know, it's a cool looking car.
I can't remember what a 68, 69 Thunderbird. Is that the one with the hidden lights?
No, that was before the hidden lights. I think that was the 70s ones.
Okay. These are the ones that look like Oldsmobiles. Yeah. Knock yourself out, man. Have a good time.
Yeah. actually, they did have hidden lights. Yeah. Yeah.
See, the first ones that come up, actually, they had the lights open.
Yeah. That was actually a cool looking car, especially the coupe. But even the four door Thunderbird, you know, was kind of neat looking. So, yeah. I mean, if you like that style, go for it.
It's not, there's just really nothing wrong with the 428. It's just, you know, enough cast iron to make the Titanic. let's see. Do you think the PSA and FCA merger will be approved by the EU? Also, why is Mike Manley shunned from the board of Stellantis? Right now, this seems like a PSA takeover of Chrysler, kind of like Daimler Chrysler's merger of equals.
Yeah, you know, I think it will get approved. I don't see any reason why they wouldn't. Especially, you know, given the way the auto industry is going, you know, we're going to be seeing more consolidation in the industry. That's just a reality. And as far as Manley goes, you know, I was reading about this. The merger agreement was because, you know, this is going to be a European-based company. So they have a board of supervisors, which is like the board of directors, but a little bit different. One of the things, you know, in the merger agreement, they said that they would only have one. Let's see, one representative from each of the companies. So Carlos Tavares from PSA, and John Alcan from from the Danieli family that is a major stockholder in PSA. He's the chairman of the holding company that is the biggest shareholder in FCA. So he's also going to be on the board. As far as we know, Manley is sticking around in an executive role. He's just not going to be on the board. Other members of the supervisory board will be outsiders, not coming from either of the two companies.
Yeah. I think that it's more complementary too than the Daimler Chrysler merger of equals. That Chrysler doesn't have any new car platforms or small car platforms, and those are two areas where even if they wanted to make a small crossover, they don't have a platform for it. So they could use it. They have Jeep and Ram, and they've managed to keep.
FCA's got strength in commercial vehicles and trucks, yeah, and SUVs.
That's true. A lot of the ProMasters and stuff are
right. Pretty and popular. And PSA, more on the smaller to mid-sized cars and smaller utilities. So and PSA, also has more strength on electric vehicle platforms than FCA does.
Yeah, and so it makes sense that FCA and it's not that FCA hasn't been developing EVs and hybrids and stuff. That just it makes sense that if they're going to buy into another company that's also been doing it, they're going to maybe take their foot off the pedal a little bit and see where they can lash things together instead of committing too much to a technology that's a dead end because it can't be used across all the brands. So there's a lot that has to go on. I hope that it works out better than the merger of equals that kind of didn't. It was a cultural clash. I don't know that the French kind of, because they're, and this is broad generalizations, but the French sort of merging their culture with an American brand versus the Germans doing it.
Well, you're merging with Americans and Italians.
Oh man, we're screwed. it all depends on how much they all kind of agree. It doesn't really matter where they came from. It's a global industry. I mean, Manley's not even from Europe, right?
Yeah, he's English.
Oh, is he? I thought he was from.
Well, he's not from Europe anymore.
Yeah. Well. The world is so complicated. I thought it was from like Australia or New Zealand or something. It's a global industry, so it doesn't matter where they come from. It just matters what they sort of agree to do, and then if they stick to it. There was a lot of promise to Daimler Chrysler in the beginning, and we got some good stuff out of it. You can still go buy a Challenger. So. That car is never going to die. It's going to be around forever.
Hey, as long as people keep buying them.
Yeah, they sell better every year.
Yeah, they sell better now than they ever have.
Nuts. All right. But that's it. Our podcast is done. We've spent enough time babbling. So thanks everybody for listening. Send in questions. You know where to find us. It is feedback@wheelbearings.media. keep us on the dial, and we'll see everybody next time.
See ya.
Any Hour Services free furnace sale is going on right now. The estimate's free, and when you have Any Hour Services install a new air conditioner, we'll give you a new furnace for just the cost to install it. For more information, call Any Hour Services or schedule online at anyhourservices.com.
It's time to get that hernia repaired. And who better to do it than a leading clinical facility? JBR Clinical Research is currently recruiting participants for an investigational pain reduction medication study following hernia repair surgery. If you're between the ages of 18 to 75, you may qualify to receive study-related medication and no-cost hernia repair by a board-certified surgeon. You may even be compensated up to $2,000 for time and travel. To participate, call 801-261-2000 or apply at JBR Clinical Research. Research.com.